Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody.
Hillary Clinton wants to abolish it. Believe me. She wants to abolish our Second Amendment.
I think they didn't deny it. I don't think anybody denied it.
Other presidents did not call. They'd write letters, and some presidents didn't do anything.
Many people have come out and said I'm right.
You really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Hello and welcome to Fallacious Trump, the podcast where we use the insane ramblings of a super callous, fragile, racist, sexist Nazi POTUS to explain logical fallacies. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm your other host, Mark. A logical fallacy is an error in reasoning that results in bad or invalid arguments. And the logical fallacy we're looking at this week is accelerating truth.
Yeah, so you might not have heard of accelerating truth before. And there's a good reason for that. It's because it's another one that I made up.
Yay.
And
I think you could actually say identified rather than made up.
That's fair. Yeah.
Sounds a bit more scholarly.
That's an excellent point. Yeah. When I write the paper on it, I'll put I identified this. So this is something that I've identified as happening from time to time, which is when it's a slight variation, basically, on proof by assertion or argumentum ad nauseam, where with ad nauseam, it's people saying the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
Accelerating truth is where each time they repeat it or each time they go back to the argument, it becomes, in their telling, a bit more true. And it's often based on the assertion that they made before. So they're there isn't new evidence coming in that they're changing their story on. It's like, well, because I said it, that now gives it some kind of
cachet. So there's now a history
cachet
of people saying it.
Exactly,
People have said, many people have said, well, one part, you.
Just now.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So for our Trump example, back in May of 2017, May 16th, before Robert Mueller was appointed to special counsel, in fact, the day before, he had a meeting with Trump in the Oval Office. Mueller says that he was there to talk to Trump about the FBI director job because James Comey had recently been fired or removed from the job. And he was there to advise on kind of what kind of person you might be looking for or what the needs of the job are or how the FBI needs to move forward. Trump claims that Mueller was there to interview for the job and that Mueller desperately wanted the job. And the fact that he didn't pick Mueller for the job was a big part of why he was so anti-Trump and you know, conflicted when he was writing the report. Obviously, most of those calls of conflict went away after Mueller came back and said, no collusion, according to Trump, at least. Back in March of 2018, Trump said this.
I had a nasty business transaction with Robert Mueller a number of years ago. I said, why isn't that mentioned? He wanted the job as FBI director. I mean, these are things that are out there. They know it. Why isn't that? And I didn't give it to him. Why isn't that mentioned?
So at this point, he's just asserting that Mueller came in, he wanted the job, and I didn't give it to him. And that's part of this whole problem. A couple of months later, in another press conference, he said this.
As you know, he wanted the job of the FBI director, he didn't get it.
So now it's become as you know, as if it's a thing that is generally accepted. Which is slightly more than just him saying it. But then, February the following year, he said this on Geraldo Rivera's show.
Well, he said in Congress that he never applied for the job of the FBI director, and now it's been proven that he did.
Oh, now it's been proven that he did.
Yeah, now it's been proven. Now, the only additional evidence that that came forward during that time, apart from Mueller denying it under oath, was that an administration official said, oh, yeah, he did. He did want to. An unnamed administration official
said to Trump.
Fox... News, exactly. Right. Said to Fox News that he did.
Yeah.
There's also administration officials who have specifically said he didn't. Like Steve Bannon, who at the time said, no, he wasn't coming in to interview for the job.
Why isn't that mentioned?
Yeah. and memos from Rod Rosenstein at the time saying that he wasn't interested in the job.
Yeah.
And also the fact that he'd already done the job for 12 years and therefore legally wasn't actually allowed to do the job.
Yep,
but apart from all of that, we've got Trump's assertion that he did, that he wanted the job, he was desperate for the job, and that's why he was so conflicted and why he was so against Trump and why he hired his 13 to 18 angry Democrats.
An innumerable number. And also the disagreeable business transaction that they had.
Well, yeah.
Which was him not getting a, no, getting a, re, not renewing his, giving up it was, his membership of his golf club
it was,
and asking for a refund of the unexpended months.
Mueller's family moved, basically. They weren't going to be able to use the membership of their golf membership at Trump Golf Course, and wrote a letter to Trump to see if they could get a refund of the remaining amount, and never heard back. That was the nasty business transaction. So
so they just cancelled the direct debit. And that was, so that. Brilliant. Yeah.
So in retellings, it went essentially from, I'm saying this is true, to it's now been proven.
Absolutely true.
With nothing else really helping.
No.
Yeah.
Just the things that I've said have been added to the things that have been said about this.
Yeah. So they're part of the body of evidence.
Part of public record. But, you know, but somehow in his retelling, it outweighs all the other evidence of 12 years in the job, can't do it again. That kind of stuff, not interested, spoke to the very many other people who said, no, he'd never mentioned it. Yeah.
But also the fact that he would have had to perjure himself to deny it when he gets nothing out of it. If he, you know, if he had said, yes, I was interviewing for the job, but it had no effect on how I wrote my report.
Yeah.
So what? That wouldn't have, you know, it wouldn't have made any difference. Because at that point, he'd already said, you know, we didn't find anything that we decided we could prosecute for.
Yeah.
So
yeah, exactly. So up until that point, Trump still thinks he's disagreeing with him. And now he's not accused him, not found him guilty of collusion, not that he was able to. He's kind of, Trump's not talked about that anymore. So he hasn't mentioned Mueller for ages, has he? That's, you know.
No, not for a while. Every now and again, he does say, you know, it used to be Russia, 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 and now it's whatever, coronavirus.
China. Virus. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, weirdly, time marches on and, you know, you just distract us from the news cycle. Fortunately, an invisible killer virus does that for us and makes it very uncomfortable for you, which we enjoy greatly.
And now is the time, I think, for Mark's British Politics Corner.
So today's example is based on a question. Can you hear that faint, high-pitched whistling sound up there in canine frequencies emanating from our politics at the moment? Well, yeah, immigration is back. When we first discussed this lately defined fallacy, my thought was, well, this is often what the media does in creating something sufficiently self-fulfilling to become a story. And the current distraction from COVID is this massive invasion of a dozen or so people in a dinghy escaping tyranny and war-torn areas trying to get to the UK. And there was a news report done on ITV News, maybe the 7th or something like that, and it was when it was calm, the seas were calm, it was nice and warm, and lots of people in dinghies were coming over from France, sufficient for news media people to go out in their own boats and film them doing just that. So one of the reporters, who is Libby Wiener, there's this report that's headlined, "Migrants Must Be Returned to France," says Priti Patel. And there's a section in here where I think she uses her own assertion to form the basis of the truth of the statement she's ending the report with.
Ministers wouldn't confirm today whether they are considering bringing in the Navy. One concern is that their presence here, far from acting as a deterrent, might instead be a magnet for migrants.
Those desperate enough to flee a war zone or extreme poverty more likely to see a Royal Naval Patrol as their passage to safety than a threat.
See, I think she's gone from one of those proper media things where it said, well, you know, we've received no denial for the question of. So she's saying that ministers won't confirm whether they are considering. So you think, well, what is that there then? So they won't confirm that they're considering it. So does that mean they're not? Or they haven't received
or, more likely, here's something I just made up.
Yeah.
Or they couldn't get an answer.
Yeah. Or they've not. So they've not confirmed it. It's a bit like saying, well, I remember when we were casting a film, didn't we cast a film? And we would go around saying, well, John Cleese hasn't turned us down.
Yeah, we did say that.
That was our. And, you know, so that's the equivalent of it, isn't it? The ministers haven't confirmed.
I should say, we said that as a joke, not to trick anyone into being in it.
Yeah. Because he didn't turn us down.
No, it's true.
He didn't say yes, but he didn't.
To be honest, a lot of celebrities did turn us down. So
that's true. Yeah. But he didn't. Yeah.
No.
Basically, because he didn't confirm whether he was considering being in the part. So
he just never answered.
So fundamentally, so she's going from this assertion, ministers wouldn't confirm whether they're considering sending in the Navy, basically to intercept these tiny boats coming from France. And that goes all the way up to, so that becomes a truth that the Navy are going in, sufficient that migrants will see that as their passage to safety rather than as a threat. So these kind of things, you think, well, the reporters are somewhat responsible for being a bit dog whistly themselves, because they're kind of speculating on nothing whatsoever in order to make a point and adding weight to the point by saying, yeah, migrants are likely to see that as a safe passage, because under various maritime rules, if there is a boat in trouble, then whoever's nearest, like that, whether they're in authority or not, they're duty bound, morally bound to rescue them from the sea and take them to the nearest port, which, if they're in English waters, would be England. Great. Jim's not jumping in. Brilliant.
I'm good with that. That's fine.
Okay, good.
I was waiting for you to move on to your next one, actually.
The next one, yeah. So the next one in the same report. I'm going to argue tenuously, just because I want to play the clip. I would argue he creates the truth. So this is a reporter asked by that. This is the guy called Kevin Mills, who's from the Border Force Union. And we'll talk about what that is in a minute. Asked by the reporter about whether this is, whether he's experienced anything like this before. Bit of a leading question. And he goes from a not very convincing set of numbers with, as if he just made them up, authenticity, which leads him to the truth that these numbers are huge. It goes from, I've never seen it so bad, all the way up to, yeah, these are bloody terrible numbers.
Have you seen anything like it before?
Not this scale, no. I mean, I've seen large numbers arriving in lorries, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 plus. But this is just consistent. This is, you know, 15, 16, you know, up to 40 in a vessel. And there's, you know, 15, 16, 17 vessels in a day. So, you know, this is huge numbers.
So if this was Q, of course, he was like, look, he said 17. He said 17. Yeah. So he goes from these things which said, yes, well, I've seen, you know, 20, 30, 40 in a lorry with his recessive R in a lorry. But this is consistent. You know, we didn't ask about consistency. We asked about size, hugeness. And then he says, but here we've got 15, 16, he's stuck in the 15-16, right? 15-16-40.
that's a leap, isn't it?
Yeah. In 15-16-17 boats a day, which
not
is
40
just
boats,
huge.
Though.
Not four. No, he's yeah. kind of he's moved that, and you think,
yeah.
why did you not challenge him on any of these numbers? But he's gone. He's basically because he's kind of his little bit of plucking numbers out of the air has led him to say, yeah, you're right. I've never seen anything like this. You know, it's a leading question to start with.
Yeah, said, I mean, to the real answer in absence of him just making up numbers was probably, yeah, it's quite a lot.
Yes, exactly. Because actually, he isn't a member of the Border Force. When you watch the clip, he's standing there in a short sleeve shirt and shorts, looking a bit cash, you know, so he's got no authority denoted by wearing a uniform in the baking sun, you know, which you would think as a member of Border Force, but he isn't. He works for the Public and Commercial Services Union, hence the union bit and Border Force Union. His job is a group assistant secretary for Public and Commercial Service Union, and his area of responsibility is Border Force.
Okay.
So basically, he's a union rep for Border Force under the Public and Commercial Services Union. So
he works for a company that runs or is in charge of a lot of different unions for different organisations.
Yeah, a bit like the Transport and General Workers Union. He works for the
and
Public
he's
and
like
Commercial
a,
Services
he's
Union.
He's like a liaison, essentially, between that organisation and the people who work for the Border Force.
Yes.
Yeah.
So he is in charge of looking after their employment rights, holiday rights, sick pay rights, you know, those kind of...
So nothing to do with keeping people out of the UK?
No. No. And he's a group assistant secretary. So I
like
don't
assistant
know,
to the group secretary, possibly.
Probably, yeah. Yeah. For that, so he's nothing to do with that, and he's going from bunch of daft numbers to he's lending a third party authoritative voice to an assertion being made by the journalist that
have you ever seen it?
So it's like so giving somebody else the job of proving providing the evidence to come up with a sketchy assertion being asserted as the truth is what she does at the end of the report herself. But this is earlier on, she's given the job to this poor sap who, you know, who they've disguised as having something to do with Border Force.
To be honest, if he's not involved in actually, you know, the front line of migration, it's probably true to say he's never seen it so bad. He's never seen it
at all. Yes,
so
yeah. And looking at the figures, the sea crossings spike in the summer when the water is calm. So far this year, been 3,948 come by sea. Last year it was 1,809. But the only figures I could find were from August 2016, which might give us an idea of the kind of figures. The Daily Express reported that 200 migrants smuggled into the UK in lorries every week. So that's 10,000 a year.
Now, as we know, the genetic fallacy prohibits us from assuming that those numbers are wrong just because they come from the Daily Express.
Yes.
But
and also
as critical thinkers, we should also consider the source and the possible motivation. And the Daily Express, for those who aren't in the UK, is notoriously anti-migrant paper.
Yep.
It is.
And notoriously pro-Brexit.
The only thing they talk more about than migrants is Princess Diana.
Yeah. And,
still.
And the death of her death and how it affects house prices. Uh-huh. Yeah. It's interesting to look at the timing of the migrant crisis because it reminds us of the caravan of thug criminals that were coming, hordes of them coming over the hill from Mexico at the time of the midterms for Trump. So the last time this, so that those numbers about the migrant crisis with 10,000 a year coming via lorries was just around Brexit time. And now all this coverage is happening because COVID, because, you know, ineptitude, all that stuff. Let's go, and we'll talk about that later in the headlines.
All I want is the truth. Just give me the truth. No straw ahead, no bones, all the tricky things. Gonna mother have a soft soul, beat each other to find the hole. A different child. Fantasy in the wild.
John Lennon there ranting about, just give me some truth, saying such things as, I'm sick and tired of deciphering some thinly veiled, poorly argued, blatant, wild fallacies. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. 1971, he wrote that.
Still ahead of his time.
Yeah.
So, in The Fallacy in the Wild, we like to talk about the fallacy of the week from a non-political perspective, which we'll manage for at least two of the examples here. Okay. And the first one is actually what kind of gave me the idea to completely make up slash discover this fallacy.
Define,
And it actually was inspired by our kind of extra show for patrons, the QAnon Book Club, because in the chapter that we're looking at the moment, that you'll be able to hear about probably in a couple of weeks, is a bit about Lewis Carroll.
Oh, yeah. And, oh, it's the whole Alice thing.
Alice in Wonderland. And they mentioned a particular BBC documentary about Lewis Carroll. And because I am a dedicated person, I watched the BBC documentary.
Yeah.
And I noticed this interesting thing, because part of the documentary becomes about whether Lewis Carroll was a paedophile. Basically, he had a relationship, a friendship with Alice Little, a young girl who he probably based Alice on, and her sisters. And there is certain evidence that, depends what context you look at it in, convinces some people. Other people say, actually, the kinds of photos that he took of them and that kind of stuff was very common in Victorian England and stuff like that. So yep. I am not in any way making a judgment or an argument about whether Lewis Carroll was a paedophile in this section here.
Yep.
This is to talk about a particular photo that the program's host wanted to track down and see whether it was authentic.
Mm-hmm.
It was a photo that is in a collection in France, and it might possibly have been taken by Lewis Carroll, and it might have been of Alice's sister. And so she got a photo expert to look at it and see whether it was consistent, whether the kind of photo it is, the processing and all of that was consistent with the time that this girl would have been in her early teens.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts off, here's what the photo expert says when he has a look at it.
You can see the little brown spots on her face. It's a very slow-growing mould, very difficult to fake convincingly. It looks like it's got a very thin albumin coating. Albumin, of course, is egg white. So let's have a little peek there. Yep, that's very thin. That's what you'd expect from the 1850s, 1860s. So we can rule out a modern fake.
So we've established that the photograph was taken around the same time that Carol was seeing the Littles.
No, you haven't. What you've established is it's not a modern fake.
Yeah.
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 He's the expert says it's not a modern fake. There's kind of a fungus mould on there that is difficult to fake, and the albumin is consistent with the 50s or 1850s, 1860s. He doesn't say it was taken in the 1850s or 1860s. He says it's consistent with that. It's what we'd expect to see from that period. And it's not a modern fake. And that's as much as you can get from what the expert said.
Yep.
And immediately she goes to, so it was taken around the right time, basically. Albumin was being used in the photographic process until the 1890s. So it could have been kind of 40 years after. So it's quite a wide range that gives you. But it is consistent with the time frame that they were looking at.
Yeah.
Now, about 2.5 minutes later, after she's done a bit of other stuff, she sums up what we know so far, and says this.
We now know that it was developed using the same process as Carol would have been used, a similar camera, and actually that it dates from the period when Lorena Little herself would have been a young teenager.
So now she's saying, we now know it dates from the period that this girl was a young teenager. So she's narrowed it down from potentially 60, 70 years down to like 5 years.
Yeah.
The period, in fact, 3 years, because the period between 13 and 15 of this particular child.
But with no additional evidence.
Nothing more has come along, no. Absolutely. But she goes even further than that, because she's now saying, well, you know, we've established this, and here's what she finishes with.
We have established that it's not a fake, it's a genuine photograph, and it's from the exact period when Lorena Little herself would have been a young teenager.
So now it's the exact period.
All right.
And again, this is just another couple of minutes onwards. Nothing else has come up. No more evidence has been shown. But in the retelling, this has gone from the expert saying this is consistent with the time period and also unspoken, but it's also consistent with around kind of 40 years either side, to her saying this was taken in the exact period when this girl was a young teenager.
So it's just, so what the accelerating truth fallacy does is provide evidence for the argument that you're making without there being any evidence. You're asserting the argument, and then you're asserting the evidence upon which you're basing the argument. So there's no,
and you're saying basically, you know, we've shown this now, we've established it, it's a fact now, it's, you know, we've proved it, when actually you haven't proved anything, you've just said it, and it's easy to get taken along with it. It's easy for people to kind of think, oh yeah, they said that in the previous scene, so now she's right, we've established that.
But if at any stage with those subsequent assertions, if she then took them back to the, you know, what you want in a kind of Python-esque way is the scientists to still be there in the background and just look up and go, no, that's not
what I said.
Didn't say that. Hello? Sorry? Hello? No. And then just walk up and put his hand over the camera. And go, no, that's not what's going on. And it's just, and then you add the kind of portentous music and the kind of knowing, there's a side of the nose tapping tone of voice going on with that. See, here's all the proof you need. And it's just preaching to the converted. That's what it is.
Absolutely. And one of the other kind of techniques that she uses in this is when she talks to the experts, she asks their opinion, you know, their expert opinion.
Yeah.
And because they're experts, they say, well, you know, I don't think we have enough evidence to show one way or the other.
Yeah.
But then she kind of keeps going and says, well, you know, what do you think? What's your gut say? And
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that's presented as if it's the expert's opinion in a way.
Yeah.
It probably is that.
But, yeah. Or not even the expert's opinion based on the fact that they don't, you know, there is insufficient. And it's the expert's decision. It's their decisive judgment on what it tells you. You know, it's not even kind of filtered through. And, you know, this particular expert, when pushed, said, grudgingly conceded that might be a point of view that one could take up.
Yeah.
So you're asserting something based on your own, you've decided already, and now you're making it look like there is objective truth, but it isn't. You're making it more and more objective with each repetition of it.
And if at the end she was honest in representing the information they had, what she would have been able to say was, we don't know who took this, we don't know who it's of, we can tell it's in the right century for what we think might have happened.
Yeah.
And at the time, lots of people were using similar processing and cameras because there weren't that many to choose from. It wasn't like you could just go down to Boots and get a different kind of camera.
Yeah.
So it's consistent with what we suspect, but beyond that we can't be sure about anything.
Yeah.
That it doesn't, it's not as good a story, is it?
It's not
as good a conclusion.
No story. Yes, exactly. There's no story at all, is there?
Our second example is a little bit political because it is a tweet from a person called Denise. This is about a story that was in Politico when former Senator Chris Dodd, who was on Joe Biden's vice presidential search committee, he talked to Politico about Kamala Harris, because she was obviously in the running to be Veep, And he said that he asked her about her ambush on Biden in the first Democratic debate when she basically said she knows that he's not racist, but he did do these things that didn't help the black community, basically. Dodd said she laughed and said that's politics. She had no remorse, which is completely fair. Because yeah. It is politics. That's the one of the weird things is when you have the primaries and you have to, you know, get those people standing up who are on the same side, all competing against each other, they are going to be negative about each other by definition. They're going to have to bring out anything that they can say that is not good about the other people.
Yeah.
And then they're going to have to work together because they're on the same side.
Yeah, yeah. That was our complaint about that whole circus for that time, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
In order to stand out, you've got to be shooting down the other one that stands out.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so that is politics. And why should she have any remorse for it?
Yeah.
But anyway, people started talking about it on Twitter. And this person called Denise said, most likely, Kamala leaked a made-up story to Politico so that people could feel sorry for her. I doubt that came from Chris Dodd. The vetting team has kept a tight lid on the process. All the more proof that she can't be trusted. She brings nothing to the ticket and can't be trusted. So this person has just totally decided
that it was probably
Kamala making this up.
Yeah.
And then said, that's proof that she can't be trusted.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then not, you know, that's not all the more proof. Based on what other proof.
It's no proof. Yeah,
all the more proof.
It's and just then, me saying something.
And then says she can't be trusted for sure. She brings nothing to the ticket and can't be trusted. Wonder how she votes. Yeah, goes from most likely to definitely can't.
Yeah. Yeah. And
brilliant.
That, yeah, most likely, and that's proof.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so brilliant. Yeah. And it's just, you kind of think, that's just Twitter all over, isn't it? You go down the thing and you just, you know, if you're looking for logical fallacies, just Twitter, just go there.
Uh-huh.
Great.
Yeah. So our final example in this section comes from one of the best podcasts of all time. It's Be Reasonable, which is made by our good friend Marsh, friend of the show. Be Reasonable is where Marsh talks to people whose beliefs are outside of the mainstream. He describes it as they are nutters. And
he doesn't say that.
He doesn't say that. That's me.
Yeah.
Just to be clear. Yeah. But what he does is he talks to them in a very reasonable way. He listens to what they have to say and what they think the evidence is that shows that they are right about things.
Yep.
Ask them, you know, strong critical thinking questions, but doesn't argue with them about it.
Mm.
And in doing so, gets a really interesting conversation and gets to find out why these people believe what they believe.
Yep.
And it's a fascinating and yet incredibly frustrating show to listen to.
Yeah, yeah.
Because when they say stuff, you're constantly thinking, oh, God, that's nonsense. You should say something. But, of course, if you just say, well, that's bullshit and here's why, then you don't get to hear what their reasoning is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, in fact, what he's doing is paying out enough rope so that they can hang themselves. It's that kind
of. You know. And it's a lovely show, and I strongly recommend it. This one was an episode where he talked to a guy called Karma Singh, who is an alternative medicine proponent, and he believes that viruses don't exist, basically. It's all protein particles that we create in our own bodies, and true of cancer as well, and all kinds of different stuff about that. So here's something that he said about HIV.
Of people who test positive for HIV, within 2 years, they will test negative. So they've overcome the problem.
Hmm.
Which also shows you that the HIV, any so-called virus, is actually created by your own body.
So it doesn't. Doesn't show you that. But even if it did, even if there was some logical progression between those two things, the assertion that people who test positive for HIV will test negative in 2 years is just an assertion. It's not backed up by anything. He doesn't attempt to back it up by anything. And if you look, you can't.
Yeah.
He uses that as proof, or as evidence, at least, to show that viruses are created within your body and not actually external things that attack you.
Yeah.
But it's just something he just said. It's not science or real or anything like that.
Well, I hope Marsh points that out. He said, I'm failing to see the join between that and, you know, your premise and your conclusion, maybe not using those words because I think that would confuse him, but, you know, yeah. And then point out, okay, where's your evidence to say that HIV disappears after 2 years?
The difficult thing about listening to Be Reasonable, and the difficult thing, I think, partly for Marsh as well, is that because it's a bit of a gish gallop often.
Right.
Because if he gives them the space to say, you know, several sentences, they'll say several things that are nonsense, and so he can't leap on everything. So in this section about HIV, this is from, I think, I want to say episode 63, and this whole section about HIV, the guy is essentially saying that it's that the symptoms that we call HIV are due to stress. It's not a virus at all. And if people learn to deal with their stress, then it goes away.
Right.
And so a lot of what Marsh was focusing on in this section was, why was there so much stress in the gay community in the 80s?
Right.
And where was that stress? You know, why didn't people who were stressed before that exhibit these symptoms?
Yeah.
And why now are people so much better at dealing with their stress that there's a lot less of it about?
Yeah.
And, you know, all of those kinds of things of saying, you know, if your premise is this, why aren't we seeing what we would expect to see, which is any areas where there's lots of stress, you would see these symptoms. And, you know, why is there so much more stress in Uganda now than there is in neighbouring countries and things like that?
Yeah.
So really good, reasonable, critical thinking questions that point out the flaws in the argument, but without being confrontational. So, go away, listen to it. It's very good.
It's good. It is good. Yeah. And it is quite interesting to hear him on his other show talking about the stress that he goes through when, you know, constantly lecturing about flat earthers and all that kind of stuff. When he does get to, because it must drive him nuts. And so it's quite nice hearing him decompress about that elsewhere. All of that shouting at the radio that we're shouting at the radio, shouting at the podcast that we all do when listening to that show, he bottles all that up and then lets it out in a kind of Tom and Jerry kind of way. You know, he shouts it all into the bag marked other podcasts and then lets it all out there.
So we're gonna play
fake news, folks.
I love the game. It's a great game. I understand the game as well as anybody.
Yes, it's time for Fake News, the game where I read out 3 Trump quotes, 2 of which are real and 1 I made up, and Mark has to figure out which one is fake news.
Can I just point out that the law of averages probably dictates on reflection that there's no reason I'm losing, which is all the more reason why I should be winning. So as you can see, I'm actually winning.
Right. Well, I think you've established that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the theme this week is actually these are much shorter than our usual quotes. And they are all examples of times when Trump has tried to take the piss out of Biden's cognitive abilities while doing so made mistakes of his own.
Displayed his own. Okay, brilliant. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Statement number one. We need someone sharp. I mean, you look at Joe Biden, or Sleepy Joe, as I call him. He did an interview and he forgot the name of a very important person. You know who I'm talking about.
Right. Yeah.
Statement number two. The worst is when he's in, like, Indiana, and he says it's great to be with the people of Florida, and you have palm trees all over the place. But he does it all the time.
Okay. Right.
And statement number three.
Right.
Most of the N95 masks were distributed during the N1H1. Now, you know who says that, right? N1H1. Who says that? Sleepy Joe Biden, remember? He said the N1H1. I said, isn't it the other way round?
Right. So the problem with this being nice and short like that is just the right length for Jim to write a Trump-sized gag and convince me to choose that one. Okay. I like the Joe Biden one is Sleepy Joe. He didn't even forgot the name of the that's I don't know. That reminds me of the one. Oh yeah. So he said I could do this memory test. I can't remember what it's called. Yeah. You know the one. Well, this is when he's like Indiana. He says it's great to be the people of Florida and you have palm trees, but he does it all the time.
So there aren't, just to be clear, there aren't palm trees in Indiana,
yeah,
but there are lots in Florida.
Yeah. Yeah. okay. All right. Okay. Well, I see, I'm quite convinced by the palm trees one and the. But I want him to say H1N1. Okay, I think number three is the one you made up.
Okay, so yeah, the other two, you're,
yeah,
you said you're quite convinced by the palm trees one.
Yeah.
Number two.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So number two,
yeah,
is real.
The worst is when he's in, like, Indiana, and he says it's great to be with the people of Florida, and you have palm trees all over the place. But he does it all the time.
No.
Yeah. So mixing up Indiana and Florida, yeah, while taking the piss out of someone for mixing up Indiana and Florida. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's that gap where he just realizes he's done that and then, like, goes,
yeah,
but he does it all the time. Yeah. Yeah. No crowd reaction. Uh-huh. So they kind of, nobody gets it. They go, wait a minute, we're in what? What? It's just, we're in it, what? Yeah. No.
Yeah, okay. I don't know why he thinks the cognitive ability thing is the thing to hammer home on,
exactly,
Biden. It's so bizarre.
Kind of,
why has,
know,
no one told him, no, this is not
really
your race?
Really walking a razor's edge, that is, isn't it? You know, going, yeah, of all the, yeah, of all the things, you know, being aged and incompetent with weird hair, that's the stuff you'd want to avoid talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't,
so,
do that.
You also think that number one is real?
I do.
And number one
is yeah,
fake news.
Oh, nice one. That's very good. See, that's weirdly much more convincing than the M1H1. Oh, my God. That means he's... No.
Yeah. So this one, he was reading this as well. This wasn't like in his head he mixed it up. He's failed in reading it.
N95,
so,
we're just,
yeah,
doing the N1. He's reading that off.
This is how it sounded. And listen for when he realizes he's made a mistake and thinks, how do I spin this?
Most of the N95 masks were distributed during the N1 H1. Now, you know who says that, right? N1H1. Who says that? Sleepy Joe Biden. Remember? He said the N1H1. I said, isn't it the other way around?
Who said that? It's Sleepy Joe. Oh, yeah, yeah. Who is it? Who is it?
It's not me.
And,
I know
and
that.
Then he go, and then, like, and then he goes, yeah, you dope. It's the other way around. But it's written down on a briefing. So which
he's
shows
got, yeah, it was the
A,
whole, yeah.
A, he can't read. B, he never reads his briefing before he gets to the lectern.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
And C, he doesn't realise this stuff's been written down by people who work for me. So I ought to just read that out and not take the piss out of it. But yeah, who said that? This should be the other way around. Idiot.
Which means, unfortunately,
I want you to cut him up in a cassette boy kind of way to make him say that, because it will be, it's so close, isn't it? It's perfect. It is the,
he did the thing I took the last bit from was,
yeah,
when he was introducing Anthony Kennedy or talking about Anthony Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he might have been sat right next to him. And he said, you know, and we're here to talk about Judge Anthony. You know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, and again, he does that thing where he puts the blame on other people. He said, you know, uh-huh, you don't need me to finish that.
Yeah,
you know it. You know this stuff. And in that way, everyone feels included and part of the gang. They go, yeah, yeah, we know. We know who you're talking about. We've never seen the guy before. But, yeah, we know. Thanks for trusting us with that knowledge. Thanks for acknowledging that we're as knowledgeable as you are. And you're one of us and we're one of you. You cretin. Well, I don't mind losing to that one. That's a very good one.
So it's time for the part of the show that this week at least is called Lilo and Stitch is not a logical fallacy.
I haven't seen Lilo and Stitch for years.
It's going back a bit. Yeah. And this is really interesting, actually, because this is a story that specifically links Pizzagate to me personally.
Oh, see? Yeah, that's all the proof you need, QAnoners. Yeah, just Jim all the time.
This comes from a Facebook post by a guy called...
That well-known...
a guy called Kano Willoughby.
Right.
And he noticed, as a few people have noticed, that Disney have updated Lilo and Stitch for when they started streaming it on Disney Plus.
Right.
It's different from the DVD version.
Oh, okay.
He shot a video of it, and I'm going to play the video. I've edited it slightly because there's time where he's messing around trying to get to the right part of the film, so I've got rid of that bit.
Yeah.
And when he talks about the DVD, this is a scene where Lilo is hiding from her sister. She's kind of, her sister is angry with her, and she's hiding. And in the DVD version, she hides in a dryer. And in the Disney Plus version, there is a wooden kind of table with a pizza box underneath it, and the kind of lid of the pizza box is making kind of a door for the table. So that's what he's referring to when he talks about the DVD version and the Disney Plus version.
Yo, so we see this shit on Facebook, people's talking about the Pizzagate, how Disney switched up stuff, right? This is the DVD right here. This is the part it used to be. Y'all see, that's a dryer. Man, watch this. Now we're going to go to Disney Plus. Disney crooked anyway. Y'all should get rid of Disney Plus. Don't support them. Now watch what they did. Everybody knows about Pizzagate and the shit that they've been doing. Same part. This is the update that Disney did. What happened to the dryer, bro? And they got the pizza box up there. Yo, tell me this shit. Y'all, I can't make this up, bro. Explain this shit.
So I'm going to explain this shit.
Okay. And yes, you can make this stuff up.
Uh-huh, you can.
Have been since 2016.
Yeah, he hasn't made up the fact that they replaced the scene.
He's making up the link with Pizzagate, though.
Yeah, the text that he posted with it was, "Boycott Disney, they're paedophiles. We have the original movie and Disney Plus made updates. Tell me y'all why this is there if it's not real. Wake the fuck up. I will be deleting my Disney Plus account. Hashtag save the kids." So, for those who don't know what Pizzagate is, it's an old conspiracy theory that kind of rolled into QAnon, and it says that elites around the world, especially Hillary Clinton, are paedophiles, and they use pizza and cheese and other food items as code for what kind of child pornography they're talking about, based on the idea that cheese pizza has the same initials as child pornography, basically.
Oh, okay.
And then, like, pasta is little girls and hot dogs is little boys or something. I don't know all of the details, they've decided that when John Podesta, who is one of a person who was emailing Hillary, was talking about food in his emails, he was actually talking about children and trafficking and sex and all of that kind of stuff, and it's just a code that they use.
Right.
It's obviously nonsense. It's been debunked widely. It's not true, but QAnon believers still maintain a lot of the same beliefs, and Pizzagate is this thing. So his assertion is that the reason that Disney changed the scene from a dryer to a table with a pizza box is as a signal to paedophiles, probably.
Okay.
That Disney is also a paedophile or something.
The obvious there.
And or like support for them, or I don't know.
Right.
Anyway.
Right.
Here's the real story. 2002 was when Lilo and Stitch came out.
Yep.
I was working at the British Board of Film Classification at the time, the BBFC.
Yep.
The BBFC is the British version of the MPAA. They classify films, videos, video games at the time as well, for age ratings for cinema and for DVD release.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to be on the team that classified Lilo and Stitch.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And it was brilliant. I loved the film. It was really good. Most Disney films like this tend to be a U, which is in the UK, it's universal, means you, anyone can watch it, and it's particularly suitable for children. It's ideal for kids to watch even if there isn't a parent around. The next one up is Parental Guidance, PG, which means that we would expect at least that the parents would have some input into making the decision of, you know, whether to sit there with their kids or decide that their kids are old enough to watch it themselves or whatever. The problem with this scene where Lilo hides in the dryer is that it may be different in the US, I don't know, because of the types of dryers you have or what. But in the UK, certainly, when you put clothes in a dryer and you shut the door, there's a catch. It clicks and it locks and you can't get out. And kids have died in tumble dryers.
Because you don't want the clothes to fall out of their own accord.
No.
So you would lock it from the outside. Yeah.
So encouraging, or not even encouraging, presenting it as a safe activity to hide inside a tumble dryer, it struck me particularly, but also my colleagues, as a potentially dangerous activity. Yep. One of the things that I had as a kind of area of expertise during my time at the BBFC was what we called imitable behaviour, which is behaviour which is presented on film as appearing to be safe, but actually if you did it in real life would not be safe. We talked in that about things like explosive recipes, where there are some films where it shows the people making an explosive device and it shows all of the things and the steps and things they do. The police tended to ask us not to include all of the steps because they didn't want to show people how to do it. Whereas films like Fight Club, where Tyler Durden said, "Did you know you can make napalm in a bathtub using concentrated orange juice?" That's nonsense. You can't do that. So that's fine. They were allowed to do that.
Stop doing that.
So part of my job was at times to look into stuff and see whether it genuinely would be dangerous if attempted, whether whether a program showed all of the steps needed to hotwire a car or all of those things.
Yeah. Did you actually carry them out as part of your research?
I did my research, and that is all I will say.
A lot of cars went missing from Soho Square around that time.
The thing is, this was information which was readily available on the internet in the most part, especially even in those days of the internet.
Yeah.
The Anarchist Cookbook was something that was readily available.
I had a print version of that, yeah.
The argument, at least, and I think it holds up, I think it's a reasonable argument, was that to find that stuff out, you had to actively go looking for it on the internet. If you wanted to know how to pick locks or hotwire a car or make explosives or whatever, you could find out, but you had to go through steps to do it. What we were trying to avoid was like broadcasting that information, putting the information in cinemas where people weren't knowing that that was going to come up or knowing that they were going to get that information, they weren't going looking for it, and equally to not put it out on DVD and stuff like that. So avoiding having a scene where it appeared safe for a child to play hide and seek or whatever in a tumble dryer. For us, for me especially, because my colleague that I was classifying the film with said maybe it would be okay at PG, I was fairly strong that I knew that there had been cases of kids dying in tumble dryers. I know it's true in the US as well as the UK. And this probably wasn't something that Disney wanted to be putting out at this level at Universal, where parents weren't even necessarily going to be in the room to say you shouldn't do that.
And of course we come from, you know, our childhood included public service films.
Absolutely.
That would go
public
out on TV
films,
about not playing on refuse sites where
and railway lines near pylons
and
that kind
don't
of stuff.
Climb into a discarded fridge or a freezer because they would shut and you'd get stuck, you know. And
absolutely, and in fact that was a factor, because the guy who was running the BBFC at the time, or at least at the time when I joined, I'm not sure if he'd moved on by this point, was Robin Duval, who one of his previous jobs had been running the public information film service for the government. So he was very clear that things like hanging scenes, for example, was another thing that we would often look very closely at, like the Mummy, where there was a scene where the main character, Brendan Fraser, was hung. And in the original version, he hung for quite a long time and was then taken down and was fine afterwards and was like running around.
Yeah.
And we cut the amount of time that you could see him hanging because we wanted to make to not make it appear that that was a safe activity and a fun game that you could play.
Yep.
So things like that were taken seriously at the board at the time. It was something that I looked at and said, this is something we need to take seriously. And if Disney wants a U for it, they are going to have to make a change to this scene. So we spoke to Disney and they said, good point. Didn't think of that.
Yeah.
They didn't change it in the US. Initially, they said that they would probably reanimate the scene for the whole, for the world, essentially.
Right. Yeah.
As it turns out, they didn't. They put out the US version. Again, that may well be because dryers in the US are different and less likely to have that problem. But for the UK version, they reanimated. And what they chose to do, if you look at the two scenes side by side, they are... that everything else about the room is identical. Mm-hmm. The table is very similar in dimensions to the dryer. All they've done is basically kind of drawn over that part of the image.
Right, yeah.
And they replaced the opening door of the dryer with the lid of a pizza box because who knows? But that was done in 2002, way before any talk about Pizzagate.
Yeah.
And it was done because of me. I made that happen. So I'm the reason that when in 2020 Disney decided to stream their films into people's TVs through Disney Plus, they decided to use the re-edited version rather than the tumble dryer version. Again, I don't know the reason they made that choice. It may be that dryers have changed over time in the US and now you're more likely to get stuck in them. I don't know. That's pure speculation on my part. Yeah. But for whatever reason, they chose to use the UK edited version for their Disney Plus streaming service rather than the US theatrical or DVD version that they previously had. So,
brilliant. So you can, from first hand, at source... debunk that conspiracy theory.
Absolutely.
You're the reason.
Which is very cool, and that's the only time it's ever happened.
It's very cool, yeah. And finally, some things we really don't have time to talk about.
Joe Biden has finally picked a running mate, and it's Kamala Harris.
Yay!
Since Joe will be the oldest president to be inaugurated next January, his veep pick could be even more important than usual. And while I did say after the first Dem debate that Kamala would be the nominee, I'll take this as a consolation prize. Following the announcement, Republicans sprang into action, half of them claiming she's a terrible choice because she's the most liberal senator by far, the other half claiming she's a terrible choice because she's not nearly progressive enough to please the progressives. Geez, it's not like this was completely out of the blue. They've had months to figure out exactly why they're terrified of the smart, strong, accomplished women of colour. Tucker Carlson did a whole segment on how ridiculous it was that people would actually expect him to pronounce her name right, but then that's fucker Carlson all over, really. Meanwhile, someone's been reading the old 2016 Trump playbook. Trump campaign legal advisor Jenna Ellis is pushing the obviously bullshit theory that Kamala isn't technically allowed to run for VP as her parents weren't US citizens. Seriously? Birtherism again? There's something similar about the people Republicans claim aren't American enough to be president, but I just can't put my finger on it.
Yeah. Retired Army Brigadier General Anthony Tatter, a novelist, former state government official and Fox News regular, which might indeed tell you all you need to know about the character of the man. No? Oh, okay. Then there's all the now deleted and since regretted Islamophobic tweets calling Obama a terrorist leader and referring to Islam as the most oppressive, violent religion I know of, amongst other less than uncontroversial statements. Anyway, he's done the right thing and withdrawn his wish to be considered for the post of Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. Fair enough, huh? Yeah, not through a sense of duty or decency, though. The Senate Armed Services Committee cancelled his confirmation hearing literally minutes before it was due as, and I quote, members on both sides of the aisle have raised serious questions about this nominee. Not to worry, though, because Trump just hired him as a temp. A freelancer, an agency worker, if you will, just filling in as the official performing the duties of the Deputy Undersecretary of Defence Policy. Which is not giving him the actual role. Oh, no, just doing the things he'd be doing if he was in the role, which he isn't. Because as committee chair Jim Inhofe, a Republican even, said, they didn't have enough information about Tatar to consider him for the position. Not so Trump. Heck, Tatar's loyal. He's a bit dog-whistly, malleable, just his kind of guy. Plus, someone's got to start making inroads into the record numbers of vacancies that have appeared in the Defence Department under Trump. Hurry up and get older, will you, Baron? There's jobs need filling.
2 weeks ago, the fake news game featured a clip from Jonathan Swan's Axios interview with Trump. At that point, we'd only seen the trailer, but then they showed the whole interview. And holy shit. If you thought the Chris Wallace interview went poorly, or the person, woman, man, camera, TV one, or the Lester Holt one where he confessed to obstruction of justice, OK, Trump has a lot of terrible interviews to choose from, is what I'm saying. But in this one, he doubled down on his well wishes for Ghislaine Maxwell, questioned the effectiveness of the Civil Rights Act, lied about the number of people who attended his Tulsa rally, complained that John Lewis didn't go to his inauguration, claimed that the manuals say you can do too much testing for coronavirus, if only someone would read them, and said of over 150,000 American deaths, it is what it is. He also came prepared with a handful of loose printouts of charts that either a third grader or Jared Kushner made, which cherry-picked data and countries to show that the US is lower than the world, if you only look at very specific categories, and told Swan, you can't do that, when he tried to compare per capita deaths. The whole thing made one of his daily coronavirus briefings look well thought out.
It was terrifically enjoyable, wasn't it? And the guy, he was just nonplussed.
There's so many memes now of Jonathan Swan just like looking confused.
And just saying to him, well, no, that's not what I'm saying. And actually doing what reporters should have been doing for four fucking years. When I was a kid in primary school, at break time, we used to go round in a throng, arm in arm, chanting, join on, army. And then when we'd gathered enough people, we'd have battles. Ron DeSantis, who, as Florida's governor, let me remind you, is presiding over a state where the number of children with COVID has gone up from 14,000 to 40,000 in the last month, is basically playing that game we played as eight-year-olds. In a pep talk slash veiled threat, he exhorted school staff to view the upcoming beginning of a new term like a Navy SEAL operation against Bin Laden. And like the SEALs, surmount obstacles to bring coronavirus to justice. No, wait. To find a way to provide parents with a meaningful choice of in-person instruction or continue distance learning. Notice he doesn't use and between the two choices. Oh, yeah. And also notice he's making a preposterous comparison. Osama bin Laden, one guy in a compound, drones, night vision, the Navy SEALs, remote cameras, heavy weapons, vastly outnumbering, deadly force, etc., etc., versus invisible, highly transmissible, even if asymptomatic, catchable and transferable between children and adults. Oh, and high fatality rate yielding virus. Yeah, meaningful choice. I choose to keep the kids home till the numbers are zero, thank you. Or until after the election, where a more humane and person-centric policy might be in force.
I think you're being very unfair. I think you're missing a distinct connection between the SEAL attack on Osama bin Laden's compound and sending kids back to school. What you're forgetting is that the government, in both cases, accepted that some people will die.
That's true. Yeah. That's the clear comparison that's unspoken, really, isn't it?
A certain amount of death is acceptable. Is acceptable for these two things to happen.
But I don't know whether I think there's obviously an exponentially different amount of death that's acceptable, but it's probably as a percentage of operations versus personnel, the percentage is probably about the same. Isn't
probably
it?
About the same.
So that which is. Absolutely fine. I'll take it all back.
Yeah. After voting to acquit Trump, Senator Susan Collins said that she thought he'd learned his lesson. As we keep finding out, the lesson he learned was that he can get away with anything, even when he publicly admits what he's doing. On Fox Business on Thursday, Trump said that he would withhold additional funds from the U.S. Postal Service because
they need that money in order to have the post office work so it can take all of these millions and millions of ballots. But if they don't get those two items, that means you can't have universal mail-in voting.
But withholding money isn't the only thing Trump is doing to destroy the Postal Service. Since he installed Republican donor Louis DeJoy as Postmaster General in June, DeJoy has slowed down mail delivery in at least 19 states, reorganized the structure of the Postal Service to centralize power around himself by reassigning or displacing 23 postal executives, instructed post offices to no longer treat election mail as first class, banned overtime, frozen hiring, and is now removing mail sorting machines from facilities around the country with no official reason or explanation given. Trump is openly trying to interfere with Americans' ability to vote. Perhaps we should listen when he keeps yelling about this election being rigged.
Within the development sector where I work, USAID is known as a big hitter, with a $16.8 billion budget being used across the world, helping developing countries tackle problems of hygiene, sanitation, gender equality, rights and freedoms. Somewhat ironic, then, that the White House liaison, ex-White House liaison to USAID, Merrick Corrigan, was making comments about the US, her employer, being devoted to a tyrannical LGBT agenda and tweeting that female empowerment is a civilizational calamity, among others. At the very least, a poor fit role-wise at USAID, I think you'll agree. So she got fired. At times like these, we need a crusader for rights and a champion for the underdog, a hero who will stand up for the oppressed. Exactly what Merritt thought when she contacted friend of the show, how come we've not heard of him? He must have been in jail. Drum roll, please. Jacob Wohl. Yay. Yay. Right, buckle up. Wohl's here. It's going to get weird. Corrigan, ex-data of Wohl, yeah, nor us, sends tweets accusing high-ranking members of the White House and USAID staff of soliciting prostitutes. As you do. She's due to turn up to Wohl associate and fellow nutjob Jack Bertman's house for a presser. Yeah, guess what? She doesn't show. Jack's unsurprised. She retracts her tweets and then says Wohl stole her phone and sent the tweets and states, due to naivety and inexperience, I became involved with people who abused my trust, conned me, claimed they were working in my interest. I became powerless in a situation and I deeply regret not reaching out to people who knew better or could help me. It's all so familiar, Merritt. You should have called us first. We would have put you right straight away. Meanwhile, dynarodding duo Berkman and Wohl continued to walk free to spread batshitness at large. Quick, to the batshit! But remember, with incompetence and irresponsibility comes staggering insignificance.
They still held that press conference without her,
yeah,
bizarrely.
Oh, well, they've done that before, haven't they?
And yeah, and then and claimed that she was claiming she'd been kidnapped, but that was ridiculous by them. Like, oh, she'd been kidnapped by them.
Right.
But they were saying it's ridiculous, that, but she didn't claim that. She hadn't made that claim. No. So they were like, we haven't kidnapped her.
And
it's
of
so
course,
weird.
And the proof that she wasn't there makes it even look even more suspicious. We haven't kidnapped her. Well, where is she then? You know, that's your obvious answer, a question, isn't it? No, we've not kidnapped her. We've not locked her in a trunk, put her in the basement. Well, where is she then? You know, if you were going to state that, you go, we haven't kidnapped her. Here she is right here. Nobody said you had. Until that moment, we hadn't thought of that. And now she isn't here. Maybe you have.
Now we think maybe you did.
Yes, that's right. There's accelerating truth right there. Yeah.
2 weeks ago, on the day we recorded the last episode, former presidential candidate Herman Cain died from coronavirus, which he most likely contracted at Trump's Tulsa rally. If you only get your news from this podcast, and who can blame you, you'd be forgiven for not knowing that Cain was dead, especially if you also follow him on Twitter, because in a twist that just sums up 2020, Herman Cain is tweeting from beyond the grave. On Wednesday afternoon, his account started tweeting out content attacking Biden and Harris, as well as Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, while still using Cain's name and avatar. Finally, late Thursday, the team now running the account changed their name and image to the Cain Gang, a bizarre name that apparently Herman chose himself.
Britpoll News. Only one sentence this week to explain Boris's activities. Highest excess death rate in the world. Impending deepest recession since 2008. No sign of promised economic uplands post-Brexit. Falling popularity in the polls. No world-beating track and trace system visible. No pay rise for medical key workers. Never mind, because hey, over there, look at those 12 people fleeing from war-torn countries and aggressive regimes that our party supplied arms to. Invading our shores in a sinking rubber dinghy live on TV. Dog whistle, beep. We're still strong on immigration and the causes of right-wing voters. Yeah, Little Britain, protect your dogs from getting their tiny, delicate paws burned on the hot tarmac in the ever-empty playgrounds because there's no plan for helping schools to be safely operational in 3 weeks' time. But bomb those fucking kids in the inflatables to hell before they get here, grow up, pay taxes, and get a job as Home Secretary, for Christ's sake. I'm sorry, I do apologise. My mistake. Two sentences.
So that's all the bad arguments and faulty reasoning we have time for this episode. You can find the show notes at fallacioustrump.com. And if you hear Trump say something stupid and want to ask if it's a fallacy, our contact details are on the contact page.
If you think we've used a fallacy ourselves, let us know. And if you've had a good time, give us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can support the show at patreon.com/ftrump. Just like our newest patron, Wildflowers. Our straw man level patrons, Mark 5293 and Amber R. Buchanan, and our true Scotsman level top patron, Lauren Said.
You can connect with those awesome people as well as us and other listeners in the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/fallacioustrump. And yes, the patrons normally, every other week that isn't a Fallacious Trump week, get a chapter of the Q book, The Great Awakening. But this one coming up, we're actually taking a short break from Q because we're doing a breakdown of the Bo Derek and Donald Trump film, Ghosts Can't Do It, which...
It didn't feel like a short break, let me tell you.
It's not going to be a short episode.
No, it's a 95-minute film, which is an hour, an hour and a half of your life you'll never get back. And we talked about it for 3 hours. So
there's a bit of an epic episode this week for patrons.
And the reason we did that is because we had this target for if we hit this number of patrons and, you know, they pay us money for the... which is always astonishing that you're doing that, and thanks very much for doing so. They pay us money, then we will do that. So I think some of you deliberately paid us money in order to make us watch that thing, so you won't have to. But we would recommend watching along with us. Why should we suffer alone? Mainly because we've suffered for our art, and now it's your turn.
So you might as well.
It is a strange thing to talk about that film as a Bo Derek and Donald Trump film. it's barely a Bo Derek film. It's a Derek and Anthony Quinn film.
With
sort of some meddling by John Derek, the director, lots of high production values, terrible movie. Spoiler alert, I warn you
awful,
now.
Awful film.
Yeah. All music is by The Outbursts and was used with permission. So until next time on Fallacious Trump, we'll leave the last word to the Donald.
That's right. Go home to mommy. Bye. Bye.
A logical fallacy is an error in reasoning that it results. I'm just laughing at super. can't even speak.
Joe Biden has
finally ficked.
See, if I was taking the piss out of Joe Biden at that moment, that would have been very ironic.